Chapter 11. Unwelcome Guests. The view from the top of the Raven Hall was spectacular, and Princess Marika never tired of looking out over Endel lands. A relentless grey twilight gripped the day, as it had done for the last few weeks, but on a clear day it was possible to see all the way to the Great Road and the marshes beyond. She suppressed an involuntary shiver at the thought of the marshes, recalling an unhappier time when Aldred had almost sacrificed her to the mist demons to save their ailing kingdom. Marika and her brother had publicly made their peace, though she could never quite forget the nearness of her death. As Count of Marburg, Aldred had done what he thought best to lift the curse from his people, his good intentions twisted by Idris Gwilt, a manipulative priest of an ancient faith now outlawed in the Empire. That didn't make it any easier for her to forgive. Gwilt was dead now, executed in the manner of the thrice death, but Marika still awoke with the stink of the Demon Queen in her nostrils more nights than not. The reek of the swamp took her back to that dark time, but she was a princess of the Endels and destined for great things. As a child, a soothsayer had told her that she would one day bear the first king of a great city of Union, a place of wealth and prosperity that would one day stand taller than all others. It was a child's fantasy, yet one that made her smile on a day like this, when even a child's dream was a welcome relief from grim reality.
"So many of them," said Eloise,
her lady-in-waiting, her hands clasped before her heart in an unconscious supplication to Shalia.
"Those poor people."
Marika shook her head, thinking there were no more than 2,000 people trudging along the coast road towards Marburg.
"So many. No, it should be a lot more," she said. "Jutons Rick was a mighty city. This is less than a third of its population." "Where are the rest of them?" asked Eloise,
and Marika rolled her eyes. Servants could be willfully dense sometimes.
"They're dead," said Marika,
turning and making her way towards her brother's chambers. She found Aldred with Laridus in the throne room of the Raven Hall, donning his armour in preparation for meeting his fellow count. Laridus helped buckle Aldred's bronze breastplate, its front moulded to replicate abdominal muscles Marika knew were nowhere near as sculpted as the armour would suggest. Aldred pulled his sword belt around his waist, shifting Ulfshard's hilt to be within easy reach. Twin shafts of weak sunlight shone through the eyes of the carved raven's head that surmounted the top of the tower, and a warm fire burned in the hearth, filling the glossy walled chamber with glistening reflections. It was a cold room, one that had seen its share of bad decisions in its time. She had long since vowed to see that no more were made here. Her brother wore a long dark cloak of feathers, and as she watched Laridus buckle on the last portions of Aldred's armour, Marika saw an all-too-familiar melancholy settle upon Aldred. Laridus lifted a tall, black-winged helm from the armour-stand behind the Count's ebony throne, where the majestic raven banner was seated in a socket cut into the backrest. Marika took her brother's hands and looked into his sad features. The years had been difficult for him. The death of their father at Blackfyre cast a long shadow, and when their brother Egil died of the Mist Demon's plague, a black outlook had settled upon Aldred like an indelible stain on his soul.
"You should hurry," said Marika, adjusting his cloak. "He'll be at the gate soon."
"They're here," asked Aldred, without looking up at her. "They move fast." "So would you, with the dead nipping at your heels," she said. "I suppose," he answered, as Laridus handed him his helmet. Aldred tucked it in the crook of his arm and said, "How do I look?"
"Grand," replied Laridus. The captain of the Raven Helms was a warrior born, a man who had fought all manner of enemies in his service to the royal bloodline of the Endels. "You do your fellow count honour to meet him warrior to warrior."
"He's damned lucky I'm meeting him at all," said Aldred. "The man's insufferable. First he refuses to stand with us at Blackfyre, and then we have to lay siege to his city to earn his sword-earth. Now he's a hero of the Empire. I've got a damn good mind to shut the gates on him and his bloody people."
"Don't be foolish," said Marika, moving in close and adjusting his sword belt. "What kind of message does that send? You will be gracious and welcoming."
His people drove us from our homes, said Aldred.
30 years ago, after the Teutogens drove them from theirs, pointed out Marica.
Semantics.
History.
History, he grunted, is written by those who now live in lands they took by force.
No, it's written by scribes cleverer than you and I, she said. Now come on. You don't want to keep Marius waiting.
Aldred eyed her suspiciously. If I didn't know better, I'd swear you were in a hurry to meet this mercenary.
Marica smiled. Marius may be a mercenary, but he is a count of the Empire. You should remember that.
Like you let me forget, he muttered.
The gates of Marburg swung open, and a group of blue-cloaked horsemen rode through on tired mounts. Most were warriors, their armour torn and mud-stained, though one was a young man who was clearly no horseman. A scribe, perhaps. Their mounts were lathered and winded, and Marica saw they were near the end of their endurance. Only a fool would ride their mount to such extremes, but what other choice was there when death was the only other fate? The cobbled courtyard was lined with spearmen in the blacks and browns of the Endels, and a lone piper filled the air with a skirling lament. The lancers looked uneasy, as well they might, for the Endels and Jutones had long been enemies. The coming of the Empire had made them allies, but no amount of sword oaths could erase the memory of centuries of bitter fighting. Count Marius rode at the head of his lancers, incongruous amongst their raggedness, by looking as though he had just stepped from his dressing room in search of a grand feast. His long blonde hair was kept from his classically handsome features by a silver band, and his blue eyes regarded the warriors lining the courtyard with amused disdain. Where his warriors were dirty and weary, his clothes were immaculate and tailored to make the most of his lean physique. Marica had met Marius briefly atop the Fauschlag rock the previous year, and had been dazzled by his quick wit, easy smile, and roguish charm. Though she bore as much ancestral antipathy towards the Jutones as any Endel, she had found herself warming to him and the cosmopolitan description of his coastal city. That city was now gone, scoured of all life by an invading fleet of the dead, and all that remained was a decaying charnel house, or so the fastest refugees had told it. Looking at the bedraggled column of frightened people travelling in the wake of Marius, she was inclined to believe that description. Marius rode toward Aldred and dismounted. The raven helms tensed, though there was surely no threat here. In a gesture of uncharacteristic humility, the dispossessed count of the Jutones dropped to one knee and bowed his head. "Count Aldred of Marburg," said Marius, "I am here to ask for your help, though Ulrich knows you've reason enough to turn me away."
"Aye, that I do, Jutan," said Aldred, his tone icy as he drew Ulfshard.
The Fayforge blade shone with a sapphire light in the wan afternoon sun, and Marica gasped as her brother stepped towards Marius.
"It's thanks to your tribe that we live on the edge of a marsh, afflicted by disease and cut off from our ancient lands. The spirits of my ancestors cry out for vengeance, so give me one good reason I shouldn't kill you right now."
Marica was horrified at her brother's reaction, but to his credit, Marius took Aldred's anger in his stride. He nodded as though he'd been expecting such an outburst.
"Our tribes have never been friends, it's true," said Marius, "but I ask you to look past our shared enmity and give my people shelter. They have lost everything and have walked many miles to escape death. There is nothing left of Jutonsric. The corpse army destroyed it all. Thousands of the living dead came in from the sea and killed most of my subjects. Fires burned out of control through the city, and I had no choice but to lead the survivors from its burning gates. My castle is ruined, and my walls toppled. Only the Namathir remains, and the dead now haunt its tunnels and catacombs. Deny me a place within your walls if you must, but do not punish those who have not earned your ire."
The Count of the Jutones rose to his feet, and Marica saw the anguish in his eyes, a genuine sorrow that she had never expected to see in him. Aldred still held the softly glowing blade of Ulfshard out before him, unwavering in his hatred. His anger had blinded him to what he was doing, and Marica decided to take matters into her own hands.
"Marica, what are you doing?" hissed Aldred as she walked towards Marius. "What you should be doing, brother," she said, keeping her gaze fixed on the Jutone Count. She extended her hands, and Marius took them, bending to kiss her palms. His lips were soft, and he smiled at her as he stood straight.
"You are a magnificent woman, my lady," he said, as radiant as the sun.
"I know," she replied.
Aldred stormed over to her side, but before he could speak, she rounded upon him. "Do not say a word, Aldred," she warned him. "I am the daughter of Marbad, and this is my city as much as yours. And you owe me, remember?"
"You're never going to let me forget that, are you?"
"Is there any reason I should?" she hissed.
"But he's Jutone," protested Aldred.
"No, he is a man of the Empire," said Marica. "As are you. Would you be known as a murderer or a man of mercy? A man of compassion and forgiveness, or one who left thousands of innocents to die?"
"Damn you, Marica," said Aldred, though there was relief in his tone. "You are the better angel of my nature. I sometimes think it would be better if you ruled Marburg."
Aldred took a deep breath and sheathed his sword. He removed his helmet and met Maris's gaze. His murderous anger dissipated, yet his hostility intact. It would take more than her simple, if heartfelt, words to quench his long-burning hatred of the Jutones. He extended his hand to Marius and said,
"You and your people are welcome in Marburg, Count Maris. In the face of our enemies, we are one nation. Your enemies are my enemies."
Marica saw Marius was genuinely surprised, and he nodded, accepting the truth of Aldred's words in his heart.
"Thank you, brother," he said. "A small beginning, but a beginning nonetheless."
Aldred said,
"Laridus will see that your people are given shelter and food."
"You have my thanks, and the thanks of my people," said Marius.
Aldred nodded stiffly and turned away, marching towards the gatehouse that led into the city of Marburg. A detachment of Ravenhelms went with him, leaving Laridus and Marica with Count Marius. The Jutone Count favoured her with a grateful smile.
"You are an exceptional woman, Princess Marica," he said.
"In all kinds of ways," she replied with a smile. Sigmar stared into the fire, more weary than he could ever remember. His horse was hobbled with the rest of the mounts, and 300 Unbarogan swordsmen huddled around their fires with their weapons within easy reach. They kept tired eyes averted from the flames, looking out into the darkness for their foes, but hoping not to see them. The night offered no respite from the armies of the dead, for they marched with hellish vigour and had no need to sleep, eat, or rest. Count Krugar sat across the fire, drinking from a battered leather canteen. The Teuton Count had always been a powerful figure of a man, broad of shoulder and square of jaw. But these last weeks had strained even his formidable constitution. His left arm was in a sling, and his chest was bandaged from where a rusted spear had punctured his silver hauberk. Uden's Jarl was laid across his thighs, its scabbard torn and dented, yet the blade within as sharp and lethal as ever. Since the battle at Ostengard, the combined force of Teutons, Cherusens, and Unbarogan had destroyed 5 more such hordes, yet it was an unending war. Each battle cost lives, but no matter how many of the dead they felled, more could always be brought back to hunt the living. The camp was within a cratered basin on the edge of the Howling Hills, which was Cherusen land, though the Unbarogans were camped with 200 riders of Krugar's red scythes. Count Aloysius had led his warriors north to the Old Forest Road, where barrows, clustered like blisters on the eastern foothills of the Middle Mountains, had disgorged thousands of skeletal warriors to ravage the countryside. Dozens of villages had been destroyed, the victims dragged from death to serve in Nagash's army.
"You're sure you won't come with me to Talahim?" asked Kruger.
"I cannot," said Sigmar, "but I appreciate the offer."
"My city is closer than Ragdorf," persisted Kruger. "It will be safer."
"If the situation were reversed, would you ride to somewhere safer instead of your own homeland?" said Sigmar.
"No," admitted Kruger, "but I'm not the Emperor."
"Which makes it even more pressing that I return to Ragdorf."
"Well, don't say I didn't try to save your life," said Kruger, passing the canteen over to Sigmar.
"I'll be sure it's remembered," said Sigmar, taking a drink and not surprised to taste the fiery bite of harsh Teuton corn spirit.
"Ulrich's beard," said Sigmar, wiping his mouth with the back of his hand. "It's a wonder that you Teutons are able to stay on the back of your horses drinking this stuff." "Makes it easier to stay on if you're a little looser in the saddle," said Kruger, taking the canteen back with a smile. "Why do you think our horsemen invented stirrups?"
They lapsed
into a companionable silence, neither man wishing to break this moment of peace amid so dark a time. Count Kruger was preparing to ride to Talahim and rally his people to defend their tribal heartland. Over the weeks of fighting, the Army of the Dead's grand stratagem was becoming clear. Isolate smaller villages in a black noose of corpses and choke them. No village could hold on its own, but gathered together in greater numbers, the people of the Empire might be able to resist this terrible threat.
"Any word from across the land?" asked Kruger.
Sigmar shook his head. "Little, my friend, I have to assume the southern kings are under attack too. With Marcus gone, Henroth and Sigurd are sure to be next to face Nagash's wrath."
"If they haven't already," pointed out Kruger. "What about the west, Marius and Aldred?"
"No," said Sigmar, "and nothing from the north either. The dead are cutting us off from one another and denying us our greatest strength."
"And what's that?"
"Our unity," said Sigmar. "The strength that comes from knowing we are one people who can count on our fellow men to honour their oaths of brotherhood. Nagash knows this. It's why he's forcing us to fight like this, as divided as we were before I founded the Empire. He's drawing our forces into battle all across the Empire, trying to pick us off one by one and keeping us from gathering our strength."
"Then you definitely need to get back to Rakdorf," said Kruger,
setting down the canteen and drawing Uten's Jarl from its sheath. The blade shone like a sliver of gold in the firelight.
"I swore on this blade that I would fight and die for the Empire, and I stand by that."
"Which is another reason for me to go home, for I'll have no one dying needlessly. I am the Emperor, and I don't know what's happening in my own lands. If Nagash is half as cunning as the old legends make out, he won't be attacking from just one direction. He'll be pressing hard on all sides. We've done good work here, but it's time for me to go."
"It will be a dangerous journey," said Kruger. "Take 100 of my red scythes with you."
"Thank you, my friend, but that's not necessary," said Sigmar.
"Nonsense. They know this terrain better than anyone, better than the Cherusans even. They've raided these lands more than once over the years."
"I thought I told you that it was bandits, remember?"
"Ah, yes," said Kruger. "I forgot. So it was. Look, I'm not offering. They're coming with you, and that's that."
"Very well," smiled Sigmar, knowing it was pointless to argue. "I will be glad to have their blades."
"Damned right," said Kruger, handing over the canteen once more. "It may be some time before I see you again."
"It may indeed," agreed Sigmar.
"Then drink with me, as friends do around a fire. Let's talk of happier times when the sun was golden, women were maidens, and old age something that happened to other men."
"I'll drink to that," said Sigmar, taking another swig. The gates of Rakdorf swung open as Wulfgart led 200 of his finest warriors across the Sudenreich Bridge. He glanced at the panels carved into the inner faces of the bridge, heroic endeavours from the history of the Unberogen and its greatest heroes rendered by the woodcarver's art. Master Holtwein had crafted the latest panels depicting the heroic defence of Middenheim's viaduct and the rout of the Norse army from the base of the Fauschlag Rock. No panel depicted the desperate fighting in the tunnels beneath the rock, and Wulfgart was glad, only too happy to have that terror forgotten. To see the high walls of his home lifted his spirit in ways he could never describe. The blue and red flags fluttering from the towers and high buildings within were a shining light of hope in the long night. To see Rakdorf, it seemed impossible that darkness could ever truly hold sway. Though Rakdorf was a welcoming sight, his pleasure at seeing it again evaporated at the thought of returning to his empty home. Without Maeve and Ulrich, it was just a hollow structure of stone and timber, without life and warmth. He missed them terribly, but covered that loneliness by riding to war at every opportunity. And with the dead rising all across the Empire, there was no shortage of opportunities. This latest ride had seen them fighting on the edge of the Skarg Hills, where the dead had pressed north along the River Bogen. A number of mining settlements in the hills had sent word of the dead emerging from cairns in the high slopes, and Wulfgart led yet another band of warriors to fight them. They had destroyed the host, but with every ride, it seemed the dead were arising closer and closer to Rakdorf. How much longer would it be before they were clawing at the walls of Sigmar's city? The Emperor was in the north, and though Alfgeir was more than up to the task of defending Unberogen lands, Sigmar's presence was greatly missed. not least by Wulfgart, for he had left Three Hills in order to fight alongside his friend. He and his warriors rode through the gate and into the streets, following a curving route that led towards the open square of the Oathstone. It never failed to amaze Wulfgart how the city had grown over the years. He remembered when it had been little more than a small settlement of timber structures, none taller than two stories, huts of wattle and daub, and riverside lean-tos. Now most of the city was built of limestone and granite, the city's masons learning how to shape stone with ever greater skill from travelling craftsmen who came down from the fortified mountain holds of the dwarfs. Wenild, one of Wulfgart's battle captains, rode alongside him and said, "This isn't the route to the stables." "I know," said Wulfgart. "I want to stop at the Oathstone."
"Any particular reason?" said Wenald. "The horses are tired, and the men need rest."
Wulfgart wondered if he should even try to explain. Wenald was only 7 years younger than Wulfgart, but carried a weight of war upon his face. A wide scar split the left side of his jaw where a greenskin axe had smashed through his shield, and one eye was covered with a rough cloth patch. The claw of a ravening ghoul creature had taken the eye on their last ride, and the wound had festered. Elswith had done what she could, but Wenald had lost the eye.
"I want to touch the past," said Wulfgart at last.
"What?"
Wulfgart sighed, knowing any explanation would sound foolish to the younger man. In truth, he didn't understand his reasoning himself. He just knew he had to go there. "Take the men back to the stables, then. I'll meet you there when I'm done." Wenald nodded and issued the orders to the armoured horsemen, who gratefully turned their mounts and rode towards the stables. Wulfgart saw they were exhausted after the long ride to the west and two major battles. It had been inconsiderate of him to put his own desires ahead of his warriors' needs. He turned his horse and rode away, twisting in the saddle as he heard iron-shod hoofbeats coming after him. "You should go with them," he told Wenald, as the man rode next to him. A good battle captain never leaves his commander until the ride is over. Wulfgart did not want company, but had not the energy to argue with a younger man. "Fair enough, though it'll be longer until you get to your bed," he said. Wenald shrugged, a few torn links in his mail slipping from his corslet and falling to the ground. "It's as far now, whichever way I go. I'll ride with you."
"Sit yourself," said Wulfgart, riding onwards in silence.
The streets were quiet, the unnatural greyness of the world keeping people indoors, as though to see so grim a day would remind them of the gathering threat. Word of what was facing them had spread throughout the city, and though the temples were busy, little else had the power to tempt people from their homes. Every doorway was hung with talismans of moor, and every keyhole was plugged with dried fennel. Those men and women on the streets avoided eye contact and hurried into side streets and doorways as the armoured horsemen passed. "Some welcome home, eh?" said Wenald. "Don't they know we're out there risking our lives to keep them safe?"
"They know," said Wulfgart, "but no one likes to be reminded of what we're fighting. It's bad luck to dwell on the dead, and only a fool wishes for more ill fortune at times like this."
"I suppose," replied Wenald. Wulfgart turned his horse into the square of the Oathstone, the hard-packed earth almost as solid as stone. There had been talk of paving the square, but Sigmar had refused to allow this ground to be covered. "If we sever our links to the earth beneath us completely, then we are doomed. The Oathstone shares its bed with no other slab," the Emperor had said, and the matter was closed. The square was empty, save for a few wild dogs fighting over scraps stolen from a nearby butcher's slops, and the sound of hoarse bellows roared from within Bjorthin's forge. Wulfgart smiled. The old smith had been dead for 20 years or more, yet still the name stuck. It belonged now to his apprentice, Master Govanon, a worker of metal considered by many to be a greater craftsman than Bjorthin had ever been. "What do you suppose they're doing in there?" asked Wenald, as a sooty black cloud billowed from the iron chimney stack and a thunderous bang echoed from the walls of nearby buildings. Even over that noise, Wulfgart could hear Govanon cursing. "Who knows? Something with that giant thunderbow Alfgeir and Cuthwin brought in, I expect."
"Is Cuthwin still in the city?"
"I don't know. Maybe," said Wulfgart. "Why?"
"We were friends as youngsters," answered Wenald. "The years have taken us down different paths, but it would be pleasant to see him again.
I vaguely remember the pair of you trying to get a look at my blood knight.
the evening before Sigmar rode to Astafan for the first time. You remember that night? I thought you were too drunk. Not so drunk I don't remember you falling on your arse and running like the Ulfhednar themselves were after your manhood. Aye, well, it's not every day you're caught by the king's son on his blood night. Sigmar and I tried it once, and we got the thrashing of our lives. Maybe you should have run as fast as I did. Wulfgar smiled. Maybe, lad, maybe. He reined in his horse and dismounted before the Oathstone, the earth around it trod by 1,000 people every day. He knelt beside the red stone, its rough surface warm and threaded with golden veins. Those veins were thinner than they had been when Sigmar had made them swear their oath to help him build the empire, and he hoped that wasn't an omen. "I miss you," he whispered, thinking of Maeve and Ulrich. No sooner the words out of his mouth than he felt the Oathstone grow hot to the touch. He tried to pull his hand back, but it was stuck fast to the stone. Wulfgar gasped as he felt the heat travel up the length of his arm, his vision swimming as unknown power held him in its grasp. "What?" he managed, as his vision greyed and he saw a host of chariots riding through hills of rolling green sward in his mind's eye. Armoured in black and gold, they were escorted by hundreds of horsemen and painted warriors in mail shirts who marched beneath banners of gold and red. He recognised the landscape around Three Hills and the chariot at the front of the army as that of Queen Freya. The woman at the reins was not Maeve, and a gathering evil loomed over the Azaborns, a doom that none could see, but which was slowly enveloping them in its encroaching shadow. The vision of Freya's army was overlaid with the sight of Maeve and Ulrich standing side by side on a wooded hillside. Both loosed arrows into an oncoming horde of the dead, but he could tell from their expressions that it wouldn't be nearly enough to stop them. His heart broke to see the fear on their faces. Death stalked these lands, and he wanted to scream, but he had no voice, no way to warn the Azaborns that their enemies were almost upon them, or that he was aware of their plight. He heard wolves, noble, white-furred heralds of Ulrich, and knew they were calling to him, demanding he take action. A sudden, twisting sense of vertigo seized him, and he felt himself falling, his arms windmilling for balance. The visions faded from sight, and the harsh angles and stone walls of Reichdorf snapped back into focus. Wulfgar's stomach lurched, and he put a hand out to steady himself, his gut churning in fear. "What in Ulrich's name just happened there?" demanded Wenhild, and Wulfgar looked up to see the warrior holding onto his shoulders. The golden lines on the Oathstone pulsed with life, now even thinner, as though the stone had all but exhausted its power to grant him this vision. "I have to go," said Wulfgar, pushing himself unsteadily to his feet. He ran to his horse and vaulted into the saddle. "What are you talking about?" demanded Wenhild. "We've only just got back." "My family is in danger," said Wulfgar, "and I have to go to them."